Thank you. So, I mean, what I was going to tell you a little bit today and try to, from there, provoke discussions afterwards, is to tell you what is it that you can get out of numerical simulations, and in particular take the case, the study we did of the black string, and that we're still ongoing. So I'll let you know where we are at the end on our new effort. But I mean, one of the themes I would like to use in this talk is, I'll show you later how we end up getting this kind of picture, which is what you'd get if you perturb a string and evolve it to as long as your code is able to handle. And this is pretty much a picture of what we see at the very late stages of our simulations. And it's interesting to see that people see this picture and arrive at different conclusions, depending on perhaps personal bias. I guess what we're trying to find out at the end of the day is whether this kind of picture happens, assuming the black string bifurcates, and in some given time that an observer at infinity will be able to register, or another one where both, say, affine time along these generators of the horizon and the affine time of observers at infinity or both reach infinity, and therefore if the bifurcation happens, it won't be recorded by any observer. So in a way, this is what we presented, and people have claimed that this proves either that picture or this picture based on the same one. So I thought there is quite a good analogy in the debate between intelligent design and evolution. People say the same thing, nature, and they conclude that there is irrefutable evidence for either one. So you could,
So these two scenarios where you assume that the thing pinches off, maybe at infinity.
Well, in this one, it could or could not pinch off. I mean, you won't see, so it's the same.
But then, well,
there is no star in here. No, so just take the star off.
That scenario also covers the possibility that it may settle down to.
Yes. So yeah, just take the star. So depending on what your taste is, you may think it happened here, or you can add legs in there, and people living in the U.S. might know what this is. Anyway, so let me just give you some details of what is that we did, and perhaps discuss what we should do now. So if you want to study the system numerically, and you first take an assumption on your line element, and here was our first assumption, in that we were not going to let a ZT part in the metric. That puts some constraints on the kind of gauge we can consider in our simulation. We assume all symmetry is possible, and therefore the problem can be reduced to a 2 plus 1. But as opposed to what most of us do in numerics, which is to try to evolve and simulate black holes and binary black holes, in this case, we don't have a good candidate of what the end state is going to be. On the binary black hole case, we think the black holes are going to merge, and eventually it's going to settle into a single black hole. So there's a lot that you know about, well, what the end state dynamics could be that you can use in your simulations to help you out. So here we don't have that thing, so we have to be very careful in what we do at the boundaries, ensure that they don't influence the dynamics, and the code must be sufficiently flexible to allow for the unexpected to happen. So the picture that normally people deal with numerically in the binary black hole case, for instance, is one where the boundaries do play quite a strong role in the evolution, though it shouldn't. What you want to do is, at the end of the day, if you have a solution, you want to guarantee that the boundaries, whatever you've done here, has no influence on the solution that you're obtaining. So that led us to actually use a compactified coordinates. We push all the boundaries all the way to infinity, to I naught. That brings another sort of problems at the numerical level, because the fields, they are diverged. And so you have to regularize the equations accordingly, and introduce a fair amount of dissipation near the outer boundary, because there the numerical description of your simulation is actually quite poor. So the first thing we did is to try to recover the critical length, so it's reproduce the linearized status. So you just put this metric, perturb it a little bit, and just, if you want, use it as a test. And through the discussions we've been having in the past 2 weeks, I mean, this is something that people are interested in a number of systems, like the black wings. So this actually took us a fairly short amount of time. In a couple of months, we had the code running, and this is more or less how the status that we had. So you perturb the simulation a little bit, and we monitor, for instance, these three quantities, the radius, the aerial radius of the maximum sphere that you can fit in the string, the same thing with the minimum. And here you see that if you take the critical value to be about 14.3 of the mass of the black hole, then you're either above it or above the critical length or below the critical length. And where you're above or below, this is what you see. In one case, it very, very slowly starts to grow. In the other case, it oscillates for a while and then kind of settles down. Same thing in here. This is the above critical length, and this is the below critical length. It oscillates for a while and then pretty much stays constant. And this parameter that measured the deformation, if you want, of the string also starts to grow when you're above critical length, but pretty much settles to a number that converges to zero after with resolution. So this was so, in a way, so easy to get that we got Cavalier and they said, well, let's start pushing things around, and that's where we were like 3 years ago. So then you say, well, let's now concentrate on this unstable branch. And we did a bunch of simulations barring the length, the asymptotic length of the string, all above critical length, and then try to see the leading order behavior after the early transients happen. And in all cases, we do get an exponential behavior as expected from the linearized analysis. But we do see that, well, late time some nonlinear behavior starts kicking in. So let me just show you a couple of movies so that you get an idea of what you see when you put these things in the computer and try to observe the dynamics from it. So I'm going to have three movies here. I'll tell you before showing them what they are. This is just a component of the metric, which in the uniform case is identically equal to zero. In the non-uniform case, in the perturbed case, you just put a perturbation in it and see where it dies off, relaxes back to the uniform black string or not. So this is a subcritical case and this is above critical case. If I play these, the projector, so there, we put some perturbation and this just oscillates, and the amplitude of the perturbation just decays very slowly because we're close to criticality, but nothing grows.
What happened at the other end?
The other end, this would be infinity. So this is a location inside the event horizon. This is R equal M, and this R equal infinity, quote unquote, though the numerical simulation, it's only giving you reasonable results up to here. From there on, it's severely dissipated away, just to keep things under control. Of course, as you increase the number of points that you put, that area where you're doing, not doing such a careful job in the numerics, it's moved closer and closer to infinity. So this is the other case where we put exactly the same perturbation, but the string now is longer. It's about critical. So immediately you see a very different behavior. So this thing just shoots off. The other thing I'm going to show you is some plots or some quantities that you want to extract from the event horizon, though numerically you can never get the event horizon. You can only get an approximation to it, and what we use is the apparent horizon. And then after we've evolved sufficiently long in time, or after the code has let us evolve for sufficiently long in time, in order to get an idea of what the event horizon is going to be doing, what you do is you trace backwards in time null surfaces. And when they meet, you have a pretty good idea that, well, the event horizon has to be there. So this is a simulation that shows two such surfaces, one that is initially chose very late times to be chose outside the apparent horizon, and another one that is chosen to be inside the apparent horizon. And as you evolve that one to the past, they should meet and then just follow each other. So this is going to be a simulation that goes forward in the future, so you're going to be seeing these two lines at late times basically depart from each other. So this is the location of the apparent of these two surfaces, not surfaces with evolving time. So they're pretty much together till very late times, where one basically starts going off to infinity and the other one falls in to the singularity. So this is, in a way, what we need to do in order to convince you that, or convince ourselves, that what we are, the quantities that we'll be calculating from the event horizon are a good approximation to what is really happening. So this is what now we're going to show you. So for 90% of our evolution, the location of the apparent horizon is pretty good indication of what the event horizon is doing. So this is what I'm going to show you here, in a supercritical case of the behavior of a black string apparent horizon, or approximation to event horizon is. So this is an embedding diagram. This direction is the string direction. So it's going to give you a sense of how long the string is. And both this size and the color map will tell you how big the areas of cross sections of the apparent horizon at z equal constants are. So the initial perturbation makes the horizon wobble a little bit, but then the leading behavior takes over. And what you see is both an elongation in the string direction, which must happen, otherwise the area theorem would be violated, because here your area is much, much smaller. And you see this very thin region that actually is about a tenth of the initial size, and this bulging region in here.
Boundary conditions on the ends?
So at the ends you have periodic boundary conditions, and in the radial direction you have asymptotically flat.
And the initial radius was 1?
The initial radius was 2.
It's 2.
Right. So the mass is 1, and then we perturb that one.
So when it stretches out in this area, is that the size of the circle near? I mean, the size of the circle at infinity is fixed. Are you seeing it stretching?
The size of the is fixed. No, this is longer than the size of the infinity. So it initially, the size, so you start, the unperturbed black string has the same size in the horizon that at infinity. And then this thing just stretches out.
So it's relative, that's why it's
there's a stretching.
Periodic conditions.
There is a stretching there. Another more interesting set of quantities to look at is the time dependence of the aerial radius. So what we are going to plot here is at every single time in the evolution, we look for the minimal radius and how its time variation, what its time variation is, and the maximum radius and what its time variation is. So this is what happens to the maximum, so using a capital M for that. So it wobbles for a bit, then the exponential behavior takes over. But interestingly enough, after a while, still in the regime where we pretty much trust the numerical results, these things seem to turn around. So not only does the time rate of change of the area kind of has stopped, but then it starts to turn around. So it's still positive, but its acceleration is negative now.
So that bulge that we see actually grows to a maximum and starts to shrink?
No, it doesn't start to shrink, but it slows down considerably. It's still positive.
This is the derivative of A.
So the acceleration, that's A dot. That's A dot. So the acceleration is negative, but the velocity is still positive. So it slows down quite a bit. On the other hand, for the neck region, same thing. So it keeps shrinking, but at some point it turns around and its acceleration now is positive.
That's also an A dot.
That's also an A dot, so it's AM committee. So same thing what happens.
So the shrinking is slowing down.
The shrinking is also slowing down by quite a bit.
And the stretching is also slowing down?
Yes. Yeah. I don't have the plot, but yes.
So it looks like for the end of your evolution, the derivative is almost zero.
So right, so here's where you take the leap of faith, if you want. Right, so here, If this were to turn around as basically stage zero, then it would be saying you're going to a stationary solution, to a static solution. This one still hasn't gotten there. I mean, it, and you can draw this crossing the line or whatever. I mean, that is not sufficiently close to what you'd like to see. Well, I mean, but you can imagine this is zero. And you can trace lots of lines.
Yeah. So, Luis, have you, just to see if it looks different, have you plotted, say, A min comma T over A min, the logarithm, the derivative of the logarithm of the area?
No, we haven't plotted that. I'm looking into that. Yeah, we haven't done it. I don't know what it is. You can pretty much, so the area is not changing that much there, so it would be a rescaling of this plot, I would say.
Okay, so the area is more or less constant over this last interval.
Yeah, because it's changing very, very slowly. So now let's try to read a little bit more from those plots.
Sorry, I'm confused. We go back to your plot. So you said at the last, I mean, obviously, at the bottom of this curve,
is it minus 0.06 or something?
Yeah.
The area must be changing reasonably rapidly. That's the effect.
Right. But we're talking about what happens here.
Yeah.
Right. And what happens here, the area is 0.3, and it's not changing much because here this is 0.01 or something.
Right.
So I mean, we will get those numbers, but I mean, I don't have it offhand. But I mean, it would be just some rescaling of this. That depends on time. You expect to see a similar behavior.
So far, these are all results which were published in the earlier paper.
Yes, and we don't have any new results. I mean, we have results as we're going along with this new code, but nothing published. So now if you try to get more information from what's going on in the nonlinear regime, so what we do is you run with a bunch of resolution, don't ever believe a numerical result that doesn't show these kind of figures. So this is what you get with a coarse resolution run, medium resolution run, fine and very fine run. So it looks like this behavior is real, so it's this one, but if you were to trust these lines, then you get a completely erroneous idea of what's going on. And this is this deformation parameter lambda, which at the end of our simulation is about 6 or so. That basically is telling you that the ratio of the maximum over the minimum is 10. This is more interesting, and this is, now we're trying to get some idea of the curvature of the space-time near the horizon. So what we're calculating is we're calculating the Creshman invariant divided by the value for the black string invariant. And if it is 6, that would correspond to a hyperspherical black hole, a black hole with a surface that is S3. If it is 1, it would be the black string. So initially, it's pretty much 1 with some very small perturbation. And as you go along for quite a long time, I mean, it doesn't differ much from the black string values. But as you go deeper into the late stages of our simulation, then you have this region, which is that bulging region, which is approaching this value 6. It seems to be approaching this value 6. And this area, which is the area in the neck, is pretty much 1. This, we're not using the embedding, so you're not seeing that stretching effect that you saw before. But if you were to calculate this length is well above the critical length for your Green Lamb.
Sorry, the neck is much thinner than your original black string.
Right.
So this curvature should be much higher.
No, because you can...
Is it to be instantaneous black string?
No, it turns out that if you have a uniform string, and you look at... Let me see, do I have that number here? Oh, you look at this. The invariant of the string times the r to the fourth of the event horizon divided by 12, that's 1 for a black string. And it's 6 for a sphere.
Yes.
Yeah, so that takes care of the rescaling of the mass. So Now it's kind of getting a completely different idea of what the future evolution of physics is going to be, because you could argue, well, here you have another black string that in itself is going to be stable and the whole process could go on. Well, we haven't yet seen that, but that's this pretty much, I mean, shortly after this, we cannot trust the simulation anymore. Interestingly, just let me just, it's a parenthetical remark, this work that we've done with mainly Matt Anderson has done last year, it's to actually come out with, and it's something I'm going to comment later as well. Here, what you're trying to do is find time-symmetric solutions describing black strings. And for that, you use a source to obtain configurations that are much deformed in one region and not in the other one. And so this is, again, a time-symmetric solution of the black string problem that has as much a deformation as you could push with that particular code. And also, this solution, if you were to plot this invariant in exactly the same way, shows here a bulging area that is, has a value that pretty close to the hyperspherical black hole, then an area that here that is pretty much like that of a black string, and this interesting intermediate behavior, which is where things becomes quite iffy numerically. So this could be another, by analogy with this, you could say, well, it might be going to another moment of time symmetry and it's trying to decide what to do next. Then something that came up in Gary's paper with King and Maeda is this idea of where a black string could pinch off, and if it does, it can only do it infinite affine time. So when we went back to the simulations together with David Garfinkel and Franz, and using exactly the same data, we just calculated the affine time of generators along the horizon. And what we do see is that the affine time is going pretty much to hell. I mean, we have 10 to the 22 in affine time along the horizon in the region where it's forming the neck. So for an affine observer, a lot of time has passed to reach this stage, even though the asymptotic time of an observer is not too bad at all. It's 200 compared to 10 to the 22. Also, in their analysis, it says that, well, this behavior could happen if, and the theorem basically tells you that this alpha has to be between 0.5, and that's indeed what we see. The number we get, I think, is 0.45 or something from our simulations. But again, we cannot push this further on because the code crashes. Don has a paper that came out about the same time and motivated by the same questions and joint conversation, where he has some similar system study that says that they give possibility arguments for the affine time along the horizon being going to infinity, while the affine time, if you want, for an asymptotic observer, it's going to remain finite. So that would point to a naked singularity possibly arising. So that's perhaps is going to be talked during the discussion. So what are our simulations saying about the finite state of the black string? Unfortunately, from our point of view, it's mostly a tease, even though some people see it as proof of one option or the other one. We still believe that pretty much all options are open, because we are here, but this thing could still has some dynamics, so you could end up with a wavy black string. We could have this possibility that I think Gary suggested that this could be a breathing mode, that now the neck is going to expand out, the bulge is going to contract, and then you have this sequence of these things going on, slowly decaying to something. We haven't seen that yet. Something that it's very well possible that we have an ever-shrinking and growing string, so this length keep going, ever so slowly, while the shrink just the neck shrinks to zero at a very, very slow rate. That it's still very well possible. If, for instance, we go back to this plot, if this thing basically asymptotes to zero, that's precisely what would happen. And of course, this thing also asymptotes to zero. It could bifurcated spherical black holes, and we could have a cascade of such similar solutions. I mean, very well, this is very well possible from just saying, realizing that in here, the region appears to be close to a perturbed thin black string, and it has enough length to give rise to another Gregor Laplanche regime, and this process could go on. So now we're in the second round, and you always hope that this round will be the last, but we'll see. Since, as I said before, all of us are supported to do gravitational waves, so officially I'm not even here today. So we have a second code coming, and we try to put as much time as we can, but I mean, it's a side work. This new code is much more flexible. There is no assumption about the T, R, or Z part of the metric. It can accommodate arbitrary dimensions, and it has a bunch of new whistles in it. It has higher order operators, we have AMR, we have better coordinate conditions, and we're working on that. And there is a finite element code in the works as well, with Matt Anderson's using exactly the same formulation, but this finite element technique has its advantages at some level. So presently, if you ask where we're at the elegant stage, where we have not yet the desperation regime, where you're getting your hands in the deep into the code and start turning knobs all over the place to try to push it. So at present, everything is nice and neat from the mathematical point of view. You evolve it. We are seeing quite a bit of deformation. And at the very late stages, it would seem like if the neck is starting to grow, but then numerical problems are showing up. And so that's where we're going to get into the dirty stage, where we just try to control that thing and push it as far as we can. But it's still way too early to say what. We'll keep you posted. I guess before we actually get into the discussion, let me say from the numerical side, what are the approachable problems? So I put green, yellow, and red lights just there to say that what could be very easy to convince a numerical guy to do. Yellow would be iffier, and three, you'd have a hard time. But those can be done, and this relates to just computational resources. If you want to go beyond 3 plus 1, then what would have to happen is that at least the dynamics of some of these extra coordinates would have to be slow enough or sufficiently under control that you can make an ansatz of the behavior of that, assume linearity or something of the sort, so that you can kind of replace the extra dimensionality by some reasonable ansatz or expectation of what the behavior is going to be. Otherwise, you're not going to get anyone of us interested, because we know it's impossible. As far as the black string's instability, the things that we've been talking about, black string and black ring instabilities, that is not difficult at all to say. As I said, I mean, it does take about 2-3 months of your work, but the instability showing up is a fairly easy thing to get. It's a fairly safe thing to get. So this, with our current code, pretty much we can do, we can analyze where Toby's and Hideaki's solutions are stable, just putting them there, perturbing and seeing what happens. The boosted string, recently suggested by Rob and Hobdevo, also would be very well doable with the code as it is. For lumpy black holes and black rings, it requires something new, but I mean, it's not too difficult at all. That's something that will come out later in the program. Bubble scenarios can very well tackle numerically, and we have done so in a number of cases. To get to the real, real interesting problem, which is the late end state behavior of the black ring, we're tackling the low dimensions first. Going to higher dimensions is going to be trickier because of the numerical requirements that will take, either because you'll need way too much resolution near the axis, simply because the fields are a lot more steeper near the axis. And if you do what Rob was suggesting for this, the question he asked me, you can pretty much define a new coordinate that scales in the right way, then your CFL, your condition for stability in numerics, is going to make your time step to be so tiny that then you have to run for an incredible amount of time to tackle those things. So one way or another, you pay that price. Of course, if life is so nice and D grade 13 as conjecture, this wouldn't be too big of an issue because we wouldn't be close to the axis. So that is definitely a possibility. And the code as it is could do this. So let me just wrap up with some provocations. Just try to ask questions and say, let people comment on this or whatever they feel like. Some things, some claims that have been made in the literature or during this program. For instance, there's one that says that the string, the end state of the string, will go through a bifurcation that goes through a conical phase. I guess at least my question would be where this makes sense, because the ansatz of the conical structure is put by hand. And I mean, all this business, it's very hard not to get what you put in. So I mean, I'm dubious about at least the presentation or the state of that conjecture at the moment. Also, anything that is obtained from perturbations or from analysis of static solutions that we don't know that are stable or not, it's also something to put question marks around, because I mean, we don't know. I mean, for all intents and purposes, Kerr can be written as Schwarzschild plus some order A parameter for a small enough A. If you consider massive scalar fields, Schwarzschild is stable, but Kerr is unstable. So I mean, one has to do this kind of analysis with Kerr. There's another claim that one would expect a sort of critical phenomena by connecting with the critical phenomena, Chapek's critical phenomena in higher dimensions. That might very well be possible, but the present thought of that conjecture requires not to pay too much attention to a very significant difference in the type of boundary conditions that you put in one problem and the other one. And boundary conditions and initial conditions determine the physics. So this is something, it's a very interesting suggestion, but I think a lot more has to be looked into. One would question where numerical problems can, numerical simulations can give you everything, but if you're wondering whether numerical simulations can tell you whether there is a naked singularity or not, the numerical code as it is has to be pretty much revised. I mean, you have to be able to say what is the time that observers far off have, I mean, where it goes to infinity or not. If you get to a naked singularity, the code is going to crash, so you have to react and modify it accordingly so as to excise the region to the future domain of dependence of the singularity, and that's something that can be done, but it's not in the current setup. Another question that we haven't addressed is where there are other non-uniform solutions that have entropy larger than the black string, even though the imposition of statistics hasn't been put in. And for these solutions, and let's put aside those questions that we have about the structure of the equations, are not all of them. I mean, the assumption of statistics is strong. You could very well, for instance, do this assumption of time symmetry, find solutions, and ask whether you can find some that have entropy larger than that of the black string, and then that would be a strong indication that cosmic censorship could be violated. So, I mean, the question would be, or a project would be, shouldn't we try to go in that direction, try to find our solutions, although they are not static, might have much richer physics into them.
So we have such solutions, right? The end state of, you know, after you evolve, you have your black string, you hit it, it evolves for a while, the area must grow by the area theorem. So presumably you're...
But it's not time symmetric. So I'm saying just from symmetric. You could set up the problem, just the assumption of time symmetry gives you a well-defined, well-posed problem, as opposed to the static case where the equations we have so far, I mean, can be solved, seem to work, but mathematically we don't have a good handling of them. This will give you a very well-defined problem, and you could go ahead and try to find those solutions, and there's something that Matt Anderson might work on.
I mean, I guess I'm still not sure how this is going to be. Presumably there are lots of such solutions. I mean, you probably already have some. Time symmetric integral data, total area.
We don't know where the entropy of that is going to be. Well, with total area larger than the corresponding that of the black
string. You can find initial data. Of course, you don't know where the event horizon is initially.
Right, exactly.
You can find initial data such that the apparent horizon has area already larger than the
right.
uniform string.
Right.
and then the event horizon has to be outside the event horizon, so it has to be bigger.
Right.
So it can't settle down to the uniform strain.
Exactly.
But this doesn't tell you whether it's going to pinch off for an infinite time or settle down to some new family of static solutions.
But if it settles down to, well, if we assume that the static solutions are the only ones that are out there, then it cannot settle into those, right?
Right.
And so it has to go in the other direction.
So I think the interesting question is, can you find initial data with entropy greater than the corresponding black hole, Hund's Corning black hole?
Right, so that's
a pinch off.
Right, so if you believed it pinched off and settled down to a black hole, that would be clearly wrong.
Yeah. Right. So this was Don's suggestion, so that's something.
I think you want to compare to black hole, not the black string.
Well, because I also don't want it to go into the black string, because it could go. Well, if it is already larger than the entropy of the black hole, then it cannot go into the black string, right?
Right.
And that's a problem. That's a well-defined problem that could be done numerically rather easily, though it might be a lost cause. I mean, you might end up finding that whatever you do, the entropy is always below that of the black hole. But it's a worthwhile question.
Very true. I mean, it's the analog of these Penrose inequalities in
right. So I'll stop here and open the door for any insults or whatever. Any thoughts on evolution or intelligent design?
Well, I have several comments. So let me just, I guess three. Okay, so starting with sort of short, meaning longer. Okay, the shortest comment is just that I completely agree with you that this evidence from the static solutions for a transition between the black hole and the black strain, which may be conical, tells you nothing about what happens in the dynamical case. I mean, after all, the Chopwick phenomenon is not something you'd ever see by getting families of
static
solutions.
Exactly.
Okay, so I think we can well expect completely new phenomena.
Yes.
So secondly, with regard to this idea of this sort of cascading, okay, so you find this long neck forming and you say, okay, maybe it's just a repeating of this thing. Even if that is true in some sort of quote generic sense, I don't see how it could be true in all cases, because you can set up initial data with a perturbation, which is a sort of perfect sine wave or something, with one period in the sort of in your circle. And now you follow that, and as you said, what happens is that you just have a minimum, you have this thing stretching near the minimum. There's no seed for these small scale instabilities.
No, there is, because the equations are nonlinear.
Right.
You propagate your one sine wave and it'll get frequency multiplied.
I see.
In fact, our initial data, I mean, it would be great if we could set up initial data that has the instability there, because it will, our evolutions would just need to be a lot shorter. This would cut the waiting time. But what we've seen both in the initial stage, something that Vignacchi went on or work on what Mada worked on and kind of generate initial data, is at the end, is the small errors, the nonlinearities that feed in the unstable mode, and that takes over.
Can I ask you in that vein, I mean, you see a nice picture there of a long tube, but can you look at the data? I mean, you calculate one curvature in variance, but can you characterize how much that really looks like
Can you write it as a static black string plus small perturbations, for example?
Yeah, and I don't know. What would you look at? I mean, you'd have to create which invariants would be giving you that information.
Well, just the change in the radius. I mean, if you look at how the radius changes along that stretch, you think it really changes very.
But there is a slicing issue here, right? I mean, you have to. I can draw all sort of slices that will give me different answers. When we thought about
there is right. I mean, if you really had a static black string,
if you do have that, right?
Each slice gives you the same answer. So if you see a lot of dependence on the slicing, even to the future of some null surface, then it's.
But what is a lot?
No, it's not static yet. We know.
Right, it's not static.
We're trying to measure its departure from
the
next.
Yeah, if you focus your attention on that one region, I thought you were saying it looks, it kind of settles down there.
Well, if I compare the invariant, the Creshman invariant, it's giving me a value that is, it's giving us a value that is pretty close to that of the black string. But off it, in the neighborhood of it, I don't know. And every time you try to compare the problem, I mean, yeah, that's something you could do. But every time you try to compare it with zero, any number is huge.
Sorry, sorry. Can you compute the Creshman invariant off the horizon?
Yes, we can. Yeah.
And can you match it to a radial profile from the black string, for example?
Yeah, we could do that. That we didn't do.
See it. Yeah.
But then the question of uniqueness comes there. I mean, do we know that this Creshman invariant has that value? There are solutions that are close by that will have this ratio also be one. I mean, we don't know these kind of things. But this, of course, if it agree, then there will be good evidence in that direction. But then this question will pop up.
You can compute lots of curvature invariants.
Yeah, that we haven't done. You had a third comment, right?
I had a third comment. So here's another argument. We know in four dimensions, if we have a black hole and we couple it to a scalar field, the scalar field outside the horizon decays, dies away. Goes off to infinity, falls down the horizon. But it certainly doesn't start to grow. You'd be very surprised if you had a four-dimensional scalar field starting to grow along the horizon. Okay, so now I want to consider the case, basically the one you've been evolving, where you have a perturbation with a sort of z goes to minus z symmetry along, sort of reflection symmetry along some point on the string. So suppose that at that sort of symmetry plane, we have the minimum sphere. If it pinches off an infinite time, as people want to believe, the stretching z direction must be infinite, right? It must be unbounded because the expansion of the generators on that plane must remain positive.
Right.
If the sphere is going to go all the way to zero, the expansion in the z direction must become infinite. So you're going to get a very long thing.
Wait, I just missed something. Can't the expansion go to zero? It should be positive, but can't it go asymptotically to zero? It's not clear to me that the integral has to be good with the emerging quantity.
But he's saying it goes to zero on one side, and the other one, you want the area, it's a combination of
the whole area is going to zero. So imagine a little bundle of light rays.
Yeah.
So its area on the sphere direction goes to zero. Oh,
okay.
And the area sort of in the little sort of z direction must become infinite in order to keep the area finite of the cross section.
Yeah, some quantity associated with that one bundle of light rays has to diverge.
Right.
It's not quite clear to me that some finite piece of the horizon has to have it.
If you write the metric in sort of, some exponential, e to the 2 pi and z squared,
right,
with the 2 psi p omega,
yeah,
then the chi must diverge. You can show from sort of just equation for what the expansion of the g horizon is.
Okay.
Huh? Okay. So now the point is I think about this in terms of a Kluze-Klein reduction. So you're on this plane, and you've got a space-time which is stretching out a lot in the z direction. And if you imagine, the metric component of g z is going to act like a scalar field. If you imagine writing this in some effective four-dimensional theorem, you get the scalar field. The description of the metric is like a black hole, which is shrinking. You get a scalar field that would have to diverge. And this is all supposed to be just classical Kluze-Klein.
But then what's the point of the number of Kluze-Klein?
Because it's not homogeneous. It's certainly not homogeneous, right? So there'd be lots of massive nodes again. So.
I guess I'm not making sense. It does sound weird, but we're already seeing behavior kind of like that. The original black string, you hit it, you use your model, you see the scalar chi gets large.
Right.
And then, so if it was a cascade type model, you hit it again, it would get larger, and so forth.
But what are you talking about?
No, but
that's interesting. What's one of the real interesting things is they do seem to be seeing a phase which is at least kind of meta-stable that hangs in there for a while when there's this.
Your simulation slows down toward the end. I mean, you run through those numbers very quickly at the beginning, and then it goes very slowly.
Well, yeah, no, but that's not. This is just us because things change so.
They don't change very much at the beginning.
And also, we're adding a lot more points there so that you can follow this the dynamics, and therefore natural time also slows down. But there's, as far as an observer at infinity is concerned, it's going. Bum, 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 bum.
Can you show us the plot again, the kind of, say, the area derivatives as a function of the asymptotic time?
Asymptotic time, this,
yeah, yes. That's what's supposed to come from the bottom, right? It's asymptotic.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So this is what I want to understand. If we look at this one, you know, is there a finite period of time over which the derivative of, say, the neck is small? And if so, how big is that period of time? I mean, it looks, yeah.
This, but this is the acceleration, right? So the acceleration here is zero. This is time a dot. So it hasn't gone to zero yet.
Right, a dot is not yet zero. It's, right. It's getting small.
It's getting small.
But it's yeah.
So you can very well imagine this going like that, and then.
Can I ask a question? Why do you stop the code here?
But you don't stop the code.
Stop itself.
Yeah, the solution here is none. Now, what happens is at the very late times when you have this kind of phenomenon, well, you cannot see it curve well here, but in this region, you have a huge stretching of your corner, so you're running out of points in that region. And then you have the code just breaks in this region. That's why in the new version of the code we're adding an extra degree of freedom here to shift in this direction so as to repopulate, well, not repopulate, but prevent the points from just
Are you forward. Running out of points in the regions where the black strain is joining onto the black hole, or are you running out of points all throughout the black strain region?
No, it's in this region.
It's right there.
Right here. So here it's fine because there is not much distortion. The number of points in here is in this direction. You remember that the string stretches a lot in the z direction, so you end up with a very poor resolution to resolve this kind of feature.
Aren't there predefined methods in numerical? Say, in numerical methods, isn't there a method of predefined?
Yes. Right. So it's a lot more complicated than that. But yes, that the new code has that. The new code has that the AMR coupled with better derivative operators, ones that they give you better accuracy for a given separation of points, and the AMR.
So you said with your new code, you've already run it and basically reproduced this. You've seen it already stretching out and bulging.
Yes, I mean we haven't pushed it, we're kind of at this stage.
But doesn't this mean that you could just set b equals 14 or something and run it and
yes.
See it settle down very quickly?
If the assumption is true, yeah, then it's true. We could do that. We haven't done the d equals 14.
Okay. Are there significantly different issues in changing b in the code?
No, the only issue is going to be if this thing wants to pinch off. If the radius at any given point, any given area, does get to be quite small. In that case, the errors are going to be just huge, because the error just scales like some derivative of your function that is behaving like 1 over the r to the 10, and that would be, because we compensate it with a delta to the 4th or delta square in front of it. But if it is true that these things will just settle down, then you can run happily with your inner boundary place at 1.5, where this wouldn't be such a big issue. So we could evolve that.
You should be able to see that pretty soon now.
I mean, if we run that scenario, yeah, that wouldn't be a problem. But we're concentrating on this case first.
Can you read out asymptotic quantities of the specific solutions?
Yes. I mean, we don't have that built in, but. that can be done.
I was wondering, first, if you could read off, like we have this phase diagram with the mass extension. So I think it would be interesting to read off where you are in this phase diagram, because then maybe you would get some measure of how close you are.
Right.
I mean, if it should pinch off and go to a static solution, then it would be interesting.
But the behavior at infinity could change, right? Everything is dynamically changing. So something that happens here will propagate out, and whatever number I can give you from this stage might not be the real number that you're looking for.
No, but for example, near that point, whether she could maybe have some experience.
Right, but that's something that you guys, if we do that, you're going to run with it. And so since we're not confident that we're at the late stages.
No, but I mean, maybe it could give an indication. I mean,
could, again, I mean, Barak sees this plot and says, of course it's going to go through a conical singularity. We don't see it, but. So, I mean, we can give you those numbers. We can look at them. Be careful what you do with that.
Well, you have these plots of the variation of the area, and I guess I was just wondering, I mean, at one point you were being very cautious and telling us about curvature invariance and whatnot, and I guess I'm not sure to what extent I'm seeing interesting behavior of the geometry of the horizon, or I'm seeing some interesting effect in the foliation of the space-time. So I just wonder if you could comment on that.
Well, I mean, if you don't have good time to qualify these things with respect to. So here we're just telling you, if, say, taking Don's lines, if the space-time were to be static, then you don't care which time you're talking about.
Sure.
So then these plots would make sense. In this case, there could be a lot of, what times would you choose? I mean, there are two times that would make any sense. So the asymptotic time, this would be one.
But as you emphasized 10 seconds ago.
Exactly, it doesn't mean much.
Situation.
Exactly, so you just take it as such. I mean, in fact, if you go to the paper, these plots are not even there.
When you say asymptotic time, you mean advanced time? I mean, you mean a null?
No, an observer that, far out.
But if you plot the quantity on the horizon, so I'm just curious how you, so what algorithm do you use to associate a time for the observer far out?
No, well, you said you have an observer far out sees a flat metric because it's the space is asymptotically flat. The observer measures that time. Yep.
So the statement is this is a coordinate time.
This is a coordinate time.
The time for the observer far out. So what is the coordinate? How do you propagate the coordinate in from infinity? What's the condition?
No, you don't propagate it. You just use that one. So
how is the slicing condition?
So what would make more sense is to do it with respect to the affine time, for instance, that observer has and that this observer has, because I'm showing you something that.
Or the advanced time. So t is just defined.
Right, but we don't have the advanced time.
So you define t by choosing some lapse and shift.
Right.
Essentially.
Which are what kind of lapse and shift choice?
So the shift is a shift of the unperturbed string. So it's like nothing happened. So it's not a good shift. And the lapse in this simulation is a lapse. The shift is a shift that is dynamically changing so as to keep one of the metric constant. It doesn't tell you anything, but it's just some shift. And the lapse in this case was fixed to the lapse of the black string. Now we're changing that. It's something.
What's the black string and what coordinate system?
In the Einstein, the ingoing Einstein Finkelstein coordinate. But again, it doesn't give you any good info. What you should calculate is something that is the observer that is sitting there.
So you were talking about the difference between the apparent horizon and the event horizon. So are these plotted with the apparent horizon?
These are plotted with the apparent horizon, but.
And at what point? Those two surfaces start diverging at some time.
Well, it's not much. So something like this from here. Yeah, so pretty much the code crashes shortly after. So we're showing the region that we trust the results.
But this is also the region where the apparent horizon and the event horizon.
It starts coinciding pretty well, yeah.
That surprises me a little bit, because I would have thought that in a dynamical space time, you don't expect the apparent horizon and the event horizon to agree.
Okay.
And you've evolved quite a bit, because you're now no longer, you're not even close to uniform. So in some sense, this happens slowly enough that you're having separated the apparent horizon from the event horizon.
Right, so the apparent horizon is, we saw, is a pretty good indicator of what the apparent horizon is for 90% of our trusted simulation.
Even after you've got these big differences?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I mean, so up to this point for sure. And maybe it's breaking here, but in between there's quite a bit that you can push.
The last stage is not clear that the apparent horizon is not a good approximation to the event horizon. It's just that we cannot tell, right, where is the event horizon at all. But right. it may
Oh, you don't have
far, right, you don't have more data.
Right. It's just our inability to figure out a good approximation to the event horizon. It's not that the event horizon doesn't coincide to the apparent horizon. We just simply don't know.
So if you were to push what you just said, you say, well, maybe this is telling you that things are sufficiently slow that now it's pointing not to the bifurcation or something like that, because otherwise event horizon and apparent horizon wouldn't coincide so well. But I'm not saying that.
If the scenario where it does pinch off and you can get some kind of singularity was the right answer, this particular code or the improved version of it, what's the best that I could hope for? What at the end of the day is
okay, so with that code, so you have something. So something happens here.
Yeah.
And you have I naught and your slices are going to God. So at some point, so the code will keep crashing at about the same point, then you rule out coordinate effects and everything. So you say, well, there is something really going on there. So what you do is you then take a monitor of the curvature, and you say whenever the curvature monitoring number is above some certain threshold, which you put fairly large, then you cut your simulation there. So in this, for this slice, it would be happened there. And then you cut all the region to the path of it within the domain of dependence of the slice. You can keep evolving all the way up to here. And then you do you'll see the converging trend. So this, then you move it further and further closer to that point as you add more and more points in your simulation. So you could build up all this.
So you could build all that up, but the bottom line is though that you're confident that you could tell me that it's a singularity at the end.
Yes. So in the same way of mad critical phenomena.
Yeah. Well, Gary and I were talking. We had thought that you were doing some kind of null.
No. Right. So there, what you'll say after you're pretty convinced that this is the case, then you could trace up a null service here and look at the affine time of these observers. Or have enough evidence to bite the bullet and say, well, now I'm going to write a null code that has this particular foliation or a foliation that is adapted to what you're expecting to see. But no matter what happens, this is the best you're ever going to get with the code.
Right. No, but what I meant was, you think you can come up with a definitive conclusion that it is a singularity?
Yeah, definitive is always a strong word numerically. You can have enough evidence that would point in that direction. I was telling Niels Hurley, I mean, every time we talk about these things, we think what Bill Clinton would have answered.
So, if this is the right scenario, I think it's an interesting question to ask, how seriously is cosmic censorship being violated? I mean, there is at least the possibility that this is a very weak violation of cosmic censorship, since the singularity occurs on an event horizon. It's not anything on an event horizon, it's infinitely redshifted. So if you wanted to get information about Planck scale,
physics, maybe, you know, the redshift is so strong that it just washed out and you don't see it when it gets up to you. It's not obvious, I guess, because, you know, okay, so we know coming along the horizon, in some sense, the redshift stays infinite, but the affine parameter is also in that direction at this point. What we really want is sort of the other side of
exactly.
The approaching horizon.
Yeah.
I guess we don't know what the behavior of the vector is going to be from that direction.
But we could approach it numerically and try to get enough evidence and from there get a good answer. So in a way, that's what happens with the critical phenomena stuff. I mean, you got enough information from the numerical space-time to then put the right answers in the equation and to study things on that with that answers and then extract from it the right information. Or the same thing we did with the bubble problem. We just got enough hints from the numerically generated space-time to then go in and write the equations accordingly and then see the whole thing.
Well, there's a difference in that case. I mean, it's not just that you approach an equation variety, but the space-time is very simple in that case.
Yes, but we don't know what's going to happen here.
Right, sure, but I'm just thinking if this is the general behavior of the general endpoint of the instability, then it's going to be generic. In some sense, you don't need any fine-tuning to get this thing. And then it will, the space-time probably is not going to be so simple as in there.
Yeah, we'll find out what the simulations will tell us that. So, but going back to your question, you could put enough. You set the bar, and you say, "Well, when am I going to be convinced that this is what's going on?" And you can build the numerical code or codes to go above that bar and say, "Well, this is what seems to be the case."
But it seems to me you set the bar. Everybody here is willing to.
Yeah, the bar is already for you guys. The bar has already. The problem is that different people define different bars. I mean.
But couldn't you also? I mean, if you could, for example, go to say. Dimension 15,
where 50.
Okay. Above 14 in any case, or 13, or whatever it is, where you know that there's a stable non-uniform, or at least suspect that there's.
We don't have either.
where you think that there's a stable non-uniform strings with higher entropy. Well, I don't know if they're stable, but at least they have higher entropy than the uniform strings in the regime where the uniform string is unstable. So if you then maybe evolve the unstable non-uniform string, then it could be that this should look completely different and it should decay to the static non-uniform string.
Could be that the first thing that it might be very well. Suppose all this makes sense. Suppose everything is perfectly set in stone. We don't know where those solutions are stable. And if they are not stable, the static solution, say they are not stable, then your simulation will not take you there.
But suppose they were stable.
Okay.
Then this should look completely different in that situation, right?
Yeah, the simulation will evolve and evolve into this one.
Yeah, so
If I write a Schwarzschild with a very large perturbation, that thing is going to wobble, it's going to radiate, it's going to do everything it needs to do to settle down into a Schwarzschild black hole. So if A, the solutions are static, B, are unique, then it will take you there.
No, but that would be interesting.
But isn't that a quick thing to do? So there's a bunch of people saying there's a nice static stable solution there for you. But if you run the code, and it doesn't go there, then you can. That's a paper. You get. You guys are crazy. There is no.
I mean, that's something we'll do. I mean, we want it.
But that doesn't. You don't have to work so hard now. I mean, we're not asking you what the endpoint is. You're just. I mean, it's like these instability questions.
Sure.
You're just doing the first part.
I mean, that's something, again. Officially, we're not even here, so I mean, there is so much time we can put into these things, and we're, I mean, both for personal vendetta or something, we're getting, we want to go to the equal 5 and finally finish. I mean, it's good after you spend so much time in the project to actually put a wrap in it. But
from what type of masses are you doing this actually? Just a little bit long for the mass?
Right, so we do the other way around. We set the mass and we play with the length. Gary was asking me yesterday, why do we do things around and around? No, it's a, so what we do is we set the length so as to be in the regime where you expect the strongest growth from the largest growth, the fastest growth.
It was also there when you go to 14 dimensions, say. I mean, even if you believe that there is this nonlinear colon, even if it's stable, nobody really would say it extends all the way to zero mass. There's still, or infinite length. So still, something should also happen in your certain basis in that case.
Say that again.
I mean, even if we believe that there is a stable non-uniform leg spring in 14 or higher dimensions, nobody would claim that it extends all the way to zero mass or could terminate somewhere. So in terms of our phase diagram, it would terminate somewhere.
How can it terminate? Because then you wouldn't have an endpoint for the unstable.
Oh, I mean, there you might talk about the merger point being a series of static. So that might be a place where you
can. Exactly. Then you could raise the scene of the merger point.
Okay, so there
I have it now. Right, that was the other thing we were talking with Rob and Roberto last the other night. That, I mean, this problem, in a way, is the toughest problem. To try to look at what happens at the bifurcation from a situation where the event horizon is there to begin with. I mean, you see, if there is there's a sequence of regular solutions that are supposed to be static that in the limit approach one of these problems, then that's a lot easier to tackle.
But I mean, if you start with the mass being very, or the length or whatever, being very close to the variable of Lambda and critical length in this dimension 14 scenario, then it should settle down fairly quickly, right? Because the non-uniform string would almost be like the uniform string.
Uh-huh.
So it should be, I mean, it should be really quick that it settles down, if it settles down.
Well, the time scale, I think the thing is that it's going to work against, may work against you, is that the time scale of the evolution.
No, I know, but like the non-uniform string near this mass would almost be uniform.
So, right, but the evolution may happen.
Yeah, but I mean, it should be, I mean, I think it would be wise to start near that
point. Oh, sure.
We're going to get to these things, but also going back, I mean, some of these things, I mean, it's not too difficult. If those are the kind of questions that you're asking, it's not too difficult to set a code to run these equations. I mean, it really isn't that big of a deal. We pretend it's much tougher than it is. No, it's not too difficult. I mean, by that I mean, you can very well grab a poor student and make him suffer through this. Yeah, so that numerical relativity is not more than just pressing enter in a maple window or something. You know, these things that you can learn. Or mathematical, but we prefer maple, right?
I have different interests there. So I think by using your five-dimensional code, I think it is easy to put the charge, right? So if you put a magnetic charge, Gary said there should be a non-uniform state, So I think it is another interesting topic.
But
you can tackle right
now. But this is the same one that in the double analytical continuation is the power, right? That we work.
That's the smear charge.
Okay.
The analog of the smear charge. I mean, in all of these, well, the string case, if you have fundamental string charge, that's a charge that can only be carried by a one-dimensional extended object. And I think everybody would agree that in that case, it can't be shocked.
No.
No, no.
You don't agree with that?
No. Let's be careful. Clearly the charge can't vanish. There must be a string charge. But if, say, the extreme limit of the black hole is a null singularity, the horizon could pinch off. The horizon still becomes singular. You could end up with a black hole threaded by a singular magnetic string.
The singular limit of the black string.
If the singular
limit of the black
string is singular, right.
Then you say you could evolve toward that singularity and absorb a black hole.
Which I think is the case for a single magnetic string charge in a five-dimensional black hole. Now if we go to the self-dual string in six dimensions, that has both electric and magnetic charge, then the extremal limit is non-singular and one would not expect it to pinch off.
Okay, so you agree in six dimensions.
With the self-dual one, with both charges.
With both charges, then it would not pinch off.
Right, I think it's a very interesting problem to study.
Right, so that's another thing that it's in the process of being thought.
So I have two last questions actually about this graph of A dot versus
so
one is you know, looking at it, it strikes me as an interesting coincidence that your code is breaking down at precisely the place that this quantity is going to precisely to within numerical errors.
No, the code is not breaking. That quantity,
I understand it's not breaking at the same location in space,
there, right.
But it's breaking at the same time. And now that's an interesting coincidence.
Right, but then we go back to the time question. I mean, the slice is bending itself on two observers coming.
But asking your question as a numerical person, you suggested we shouldn't trust any numerical graph unless there were several plots of different refinements.
There are.
So
there are like four lines in here.
Oh, are there?
Yeah.
Thank you. Okay, that's what I wanted to know. Very good. Very good.
You cannot see here, there are like two lines.
Okay.
But there are at least three lines here.
So let's ask my other question. We already agreed that this is not a physical time. It's hard to interpret this. Now, you folks had already seen that if you relate your asymptotic time to affine parameter on the horizon, the affine parameter is becoming huge. So it's clear that if we replot this against affine parameter, it just splats.
Exactly.
All right. Now, it would still be interesting, of course, to replot it against advanced time.
But you have to define the affine time. Remember our simulation that hasn't reached here. We cannot define it.
You've got a boundary. You have an asymptotic region where the space-time is still essentially flat. All you need to do is take some, orbit of your timeline killing, or your asymptotic killing field up there and shoot in some null rays and define the space-time.
Wait. Remember, our simulation, so it's doing this. So at some point you break, say it's here. So this is all you know of your space-time.
Yeah.
Which is different. So if I want, so I'm not here. You're saying, well, let's shoot out.
You got this piece out here. I see.
Right. You don't have this piece. This is non-existent.
Does your code breaks before an observer? Well, let's see. So your code breaks at some point. So there's, and if you run a light ray back from the point on the horizon where your code breaks.
Right.
So run it this way. Okay. And it intersects your initial surface someplace.
Yes.
Okay, I guess the relevant question is, at that intersection point, at that intersection point, is the space-time fairly flat, or is that close to the black string?
Why would it be fairly flat?
Well, if you run your code for a long period of time, I don't know what long is, but if you run your code, roughly speaking, several light crossing times of the original black string, then you should be able to get out to where the space-time is fairly flat.
Right.
Okay. In that case, you can treat that as approximately a flat space.
This part.
That part.
All right. Yeah.
Right. And now I want to, should track that point as it moves forward in time.
In this direction? Yeah. That direction moves
forward. No, the space-time is fairly flat. So I want to choose a direction which corresponds, roughly speaking, to what would have been a time translation.
Okay.
And then shoot in some more null rays.
Yeah,
I have to move
in
a little bit.
So
let me step in a little bit.
Well, you're here?
Let's step into there.
Right, and then?
Yeah, and now let me choose what would be...
And
shoot in some null rays.
Which way?
Yeah.
In.
From there.
Okay.
Yeah. So that gives me a nice definition of advanced time.
Okay. So this time, or you'll define, right, so this time.
Yeah.
Okay, so that time is awfully close to that time.
I don't think it is. I mean, I think it is at the it is the initial stages. Okay, if I could do this, so like from the very early stages.
We can do that. But this, you're about 150 m far from the black hole.
Right.
There, the space time is fairly flat.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
You're quite a ways out.
Yeah.
And so what you're saying is that time is. So the shift has gone pretty close to zero, and the lapse is pretty close to one. So that time, is that time. I mean, there are going to be differences. I agree, but it's
but he's measuring that time on a different piece of the horizon, though. I mean, he wouldn't actually
he doesn't
be able to run it back.
What that time is on the same slice as the point. He wants to ask what that time is at the point on that observer's worldwide that could send light signals to whatever. Your interest is in space.
And I think the ratio is something like 6 to 1. I mean, I think it scales with the effective size in this horizon. So I think it goes from being more or less equal to your I think my advanced time goes from being more or less equal to your asymptotic time in your early stages to being a factor of 6 off in the late stages in a way that I think speeds up this this time change by a factor of 6.
The advanced time doesn't get as big. Right? And if that's the time on the same slice, the advanced time must be smaller.
Yeah.
So it's probably a factor.
So if I multiply your A dot by a factor that starts at 1 and goes to 6 later, it flattens out the curve in some way.
Right.
I'd be curious to see exactly how it flattened out the curve.
But it won't be giving you more input what's here. Or what else would you extract from it?
It would tell you from the point of view of an observer of the advanced time, which is one way to measure asymptotic time along the horizon. Okay, it would tell you, is this thing slowing down? That is, from the standpoint of someone sort of far away, does this neck look like it's becoming approximately a static black string, or is it still changing at some significant rate?
Maybe I should just say, I mean, if you want to believe that this is going to settle down to some new non-uniform string, I think it's much more likely that there's an overshoot and a relaxation mechanism, and it will just sort of evolve uniformly, slow down, and stop. And that, for me, I think that's what happens much more often. I mean, you kick it, you get some instability, it shoots, and then you get some sort of relaxation. So I expect the bulge just to actually shrink, not just sort of expand and stop.
Potentially a possibility, but why do you say it's much more likely? I mean, when I was a young student, I learned there are 3 types of damped harmonic oscillators: overdamped, underdamped, and underdamped.
I only learned once.
You shouldn't have skipped those out of class. Any other insult, comment? Any other comment about this plot?
I think we're
reading
that plot.
Okay, thank you. Thank you.